We discussed how to quantize in principle a system with gauge symmetries. Quantization of gauge systems. So let me summarize this briefly before we go into quantum geometry. And so we had this, we had a set of constraints. First, we had basic kinematical phase space. And so this means that in particular, you have you have to choose technically a so-called basic set, and of so-called separate point separating phase space functions. So point separating is actually refers to set, so it's a point separating set. And the point separating set, it means, you know, usually it's your set Q, I, P, I, P, J, and I, J run just through the dimension of your phase space or half the dimension. So point separating means that it's a basic set of phase space functions like these coordinate functions, which allow you to specify whose values allow you to specify a point in your phase space. If you would leave one coordinate function out of the set, of course, then you can't really see anymore where you are on this axis, Pn, say. So that's all what it means. So it just means that you need sufficiently many phase space functions to parameterize your full phase space. And you need to select the set because the first thing what you want to do is to construct your kinematical Hilbert space. Usually you're not constructing it, but choosing it. But anyways, kinematical Hilbert space. And then again, in slightly technical language, it's carrying a representation of your observable. Carrying a representation of your observable algebra. So this you could call observable algebra. And in particular, it's with respect to the Poisson bracket. And as you know, this carrying representation of observable algebra means that Poisson bracket should be converted into commutators. And there's always an IH bar or minus IH bar. And with my convention is this one. So you map a phase space function f into an operator f. So ideally, this basic set of phase space function should be closed under the Poisson brackets. Not always the case, but that's, I mean, it's usually the case if you make this a simple choice, but we will have a more complicated choice, as we will see in gravity. And then you want to find basically a procedure which puts heads over your phase space functions, over this basic set. And you know, applying this procedure, you want such a property. And then the entire thing is called an algebra, a homomorphism of algebras, I guess. And I say that you might have heard it, but you cannot do this for the, in general, you cannot do that for all phase-based functions. So at least on Rn, there are obstructions if you want to have this property for all phase-based functions. You have to usually select a certain set of phase-based functions for which you can realize that. And that's known in Rn, it's known as van Hove theorem, for instance. And indeed, we will see, or it's actually, you know, say in loop quantum gravity, like this choice of basic set of phase-based functions is the main point. and after that, everything follows more or less uniquely. Okay, so you have to, you get this, and so this gives you Harkin. And then a second point is you have to find a quantization of the constraints. So ideally, again, you should choose your set of basic set of phase-based functions so that it's easy to find a quantization of these things. And this is, again, also not always the case. And in particular, you want to achieve so let me note that if you have a real function here, you want, of course, to put it into a self-adjoint operator. So this is all these technical details I'm leaving out. So here, in principle, you would also think to quantize these as self-adjoint operators. There might be a problem with this. So you want that this algebra is actually reproduced on the quantum level, at least in the sense that say in this form. So we might allow for some slight change in your structure constants. And then what might happen is actually that these things are also, in case that these are phase-space dependent, they have to be also quantized. And so that will be the case in 4D gravity. These are phase-space dependent. And you want to achieve that for the following reason, because you want to find physical states and these are defined to be solutions of the constraints. Which means that these physical states should be annihilated by all constraints at once. And so assume this commutator doesn't hold. Assume you get something where two constraints. Give you a constant. Like Q and P. It's roughly I or I H bar, if I remember correctly. And so can you satisfy that Q apply to a phase space function and P apply to a phase, Q apply to a wave function and P apply to a wave function is exactly zero. You can't indeed because there's a Heisenberg uncertainty relation, which tells you that at least the fluctuations around zero are at least as large as the commutator. So if I have this, this is equal to a constant or something which doesn't vanish on a constraint hypersurface. So if you have these situations, they're sometimes called anomalies. And indeed, they are related to the anomalies in the covariant formalism because they are doing the same thing. They mean that your symmetry algebra is not realized in the quantum in the quantum case. And because of this condition, it usually tells you that your space of solution might be even much smaller than you would classically expect from the counting of degrees of freedom. So here it means that you lose completely 1 degree of freedom in a sense. Because you cannot really find anything which satisfies both these things at the same time. And so another comment is that if you have this situation that you have actually phase-based dependent structure constants, and you want to quantize these things as being symmetric or self-adjoint, you know, then if these are symmetric or self-adjoint, so let's keep it symmetric, then the commutator is a symmetric operator, assuming that the commutator is a symmetric operator. I think at least it's symmetric, but might not be self-adjoint anymore. But then you would expect something, I mean, you can expect something symmetric on the right-hand side. However, here you have an ordering problem. And if you would apply a symmetric ordering here on the right-hand side, you get the F to the right. And so F to the right applied to a wave function might not be annihilated anymore by your constraint. So you actually prefer this kind of ordering, but it might not be a priori define your symmetric operator. So these are all these difficulties which come in if you really have an algebra which is structure functions, so-called structure functions. Luckily, in 3D, we don't really have these difficulties because we can take this easy algebra which we defined in our first order formalism. Okay. So find physical state solutions of the constraints. So let me just finish here. The last point would be to find the physical inner product, as we discussed yesterday for the parameterized particle. And so I hope I will give you, might end up seeing that in 3D gravity, what you can do. Okay. Also, it's not completely solved yet for 3D gravity, I believe. So that's the program what we have to do, and we will actually start with our basic kinematic phase space and quantize this. So now it's really in a new section, quantum geometry. And so we actually have to go through this decision process and think what are our basic set of phase-based functions which we actually want to quantize. And so you could say, just take the connection which we had, AGA, and just take the conjugated variable and quantize these things. However, these are point-like fields or fields at a point, and actually, you can never quantize these as self-adjoint operators. So even in standard field theory, so let's go back to standard field theory. Also, you write it every day, basically, these operators, but they're actually not operators. Standard field theory, and so at some point we will consider a curved spacetime. No, you would say, but I have seen so often that we take phi and p, or my annihilation operator and creation operator, and I put hat over it, over these things. You know, so I hope you have seen that, but I'm not sure. So that's how one usually does discuss these things. However, I have this equal time commutation relation. And so the difference to quantum mechanics is that on the right hand side, you have actually here a distribution, which is a singular object. And so indeed, these things, you know, cannot be quantized as nice self-adjoint or whatever this is. Operators, but they are so-called operator-valued distributions. And so what do you do if you have a distribution? I mean, the theory of distribution mathematically is actually defined via basically smearing, or via its action on a nice space of functions. And I won't get into this. So typically what you do is you select, and it's a bit confusing because actually the smeared functions are sometimes called distributions. Anyway, the Schwarz or temperate space of temperate distributions or Schwarz distributions or whatever. So these are very nice functions, F, which are smooth and nicely falling off and these things. And so what you typically define is actually these so-called smeared operators. And so you see actually that also in quantum field theory, there's a well-defined sense in which you cannot define a point-like object, you know, because in principle, you have always to operate with this smeared object, just that in the end, nobody cares about that. And so here you start to see the first problem if you are really doing curve space time, because you would have to put a square root of g inside here. And so the conjugated thing, okay, you would call it pg, and px. And here you don't need to put a square root of g, because p happens to be a density, which just actually follows from these identities and how you define p. So this is actually a scalar density. Density. And so in principle, you would have to consider this algebra of phase space functions where f labeled by phase space by test functions fg in a nice space, which I call nice. Okay. And so this is just a set, and the next thing will be the Poisson bracket. So now we have the problem taking these things that if you compute the Poisson bracket between these smeared phase space functions, that can be easily done because you just put the integrals, commutes with integration, and so on. And these phase space, these test functions are so nice that you can do everything with these functions. and so you will find that you get f of x, g of x. That was a bad choice. So f prime. So let's call it f prime to. Oh, which I anyway forgot here, f prime of x. So f prime is just a different smearing function. But then you have actually square root of g here appearing. And you see that what happens is that here you have a 3D integral. And here you have a 3D integral. So one 3D integral is killed by this delta function, but you are left over with one 3D integral, but still you need to integrate to find an integration measure. And if you want to define something diffeomorphous and invariant or covariant, you have to take here the square root of g. So this is fine as long as you do scalar field theory on a fixed curved background, but in case that you actually want to do full quantum gravity, we really have to worry about what are natural smearings for these things, and how do we avoid something like square root of g in our Poisson brackets, because this would be a complicated operator expressed in our basic variables.
Is there any intuitive reason why you included the square root of g with a phi and not a pi? Like, why did you not do a quarter root? Like,
yeah, phi. So phi is really a scalar, and so you cannot integrate scalars. You have always to integrate with a square root of g. So like the Einstein action is r times square root of g to make the integral invariant under diffeomorphisms to get something invariant. P is so it's basically because it's a variation of an action which is supposed to be diffeomorphism invariant, or at least invariant under coordinate transformation with respect to scalar. this turns out to be a scalar density. And so technically, actually, these delta functions, it's a funny remark, which I don't really completely understand. So technically, people say that in the first entry, it's a scalar, and in the second, it's a scalar density. Which just means that there's one way to integrate it naturally, but not in the other thing. So it's basically if you take for any variational derivative of something diffeomorphism invariant with respect to a scalar, you get a scalar density. And so typically the momenta are naturally densities, typically. Okay. So you see that we have to think a bit to find really something a useful smearing. And so the approach taken in loop quantum gravity is actually that one in a sense does is a minimal smearing. So that you don't have a delta distribution here, but you also don't want to have an integral. So what happens is that you actually don't do a 3D smearing, or 2D in our case, but you distribute, you know, lower dimensional smearing so that in the end you get really a constant on the right hand side. And so in 2D, we will smear both kinds of operators, phase space functions, over 1D objects. And in 3D, so in 3 plus 1, one would do like the connection. One would naturally smear it over one dimensional objects because it's a connection, and the fluxes over surfaces. And because of this, basically, you know, you get 2 plus 1, so you smear here only over something which is in the sum 3-dimensional. And so this 3-dimensional smearing is killed by the phase space function, and you are just left with a constant or with 0. And so you get actually Poisson bracket relations, which look a bit almost topological in the sense that it's only important whether some object cuts through another object or not. And so this is the main point. This is actually the main point about loop quantum gravity, and it leads to many repercussions, but you can typically trace it back to this point. Yeah?
Just one question about the logic. So we're introducing smearing because we want to get square root of g in our definition, or is it because we're unhappy with the distributional sense of
Yeah, so it's all, you have always to introduce smearing in principle. I mean, if, you know.
So in QFT, why can we
so
get
if you have grown up in Germany, you have always to introduce smearing? No. In QFT, so in principle, in QFT, you also do that. But people learned, I mean, because the operators which you get by not smearing are not really operators, but there's these operator value distributions. And, you know, it's a bit much more complicated to discuss these things, but as long as you're on Minkowski space and flat, you don't care much about it. Because there's a unique representation and many things don't really, you don't need to care about it and can in practice work with your point-like operators. But in fact, you know, then actually in experiments, in the end, you kind of always smear. That's also, and so here really is the question to find a good smearing. So even if we would not smear, you know, in the end we would have the delta function on the right hand side, and so the delta function itself is some kind of coordinate dependent object, and you could say it's also not an extremely nice object to have in your supposedly nicely diffeomorphism covariant theory.
I guess in principle, before we could define, like the way the delta is defined as an integral, we could define it with a square root of g in the integral and find the distribution that is
like. Yeah, but then the square root of, then you again have this problem to represent the square root of g, which in this object, so it's. Okay. Yeah. So it will turn out that, okay, you know, a connection connection is there to transport things, and if you integrate it, it will be a holonomy, so-called holonomy. And so the holonomy is integrated over a path. Gamma. And so these will be smeared over one-dimensional objects. And so if you're in 2 plus 1D, our fluxes, and this comes from one form. So if you integrate one forms, they can be naturally integrated over one-dimensional objects over paths without specifying any additional square root of g or integration measure or something. So that's a theory of forms. And so here we don't really have a form. But what one does is actually these things only have been introduced only by me to get something canonically conjugated to these things to have the right conicas. So what one actually does is one goes back to the little n binds and these or EBK, and so here we will have a one form again, which also can be integrated over one dimensional objects. So this will be also integrated over another path. And I will, at some point I will call it gamma star, because in a sense it will be dual to gamma. Okay. And so these objects will be called holonomies, as is written there. And these will be fluxes. And the only thing which happens in 3 plus 1 is that flux will be smeared over surfaces. And for this, you dualize these things, which are vectors. If you dualize in 3D, you get a 2 form. And then you can integrate these things. Okay. So we actually start to describe our holonomies. And so here, finally, I need actually to introduce Lie algebra valued forms, or at least Lie algebra valued connection. And so in principle, we already have done it by working with coordinates. So we have these objects. The connection and triads, and they come with these internal indices, and we could also pull up these indices because we just have this as internal matrix, our Kronecker delta, so a Euclidean matrix. And so formally, at some point, you know, for the connection, it will not be very important. We can introduce a basis. Okay, and I might not be consistent in writing the indices up or down, where this is a Lie algebra basis. And in our case, we have three indices, so we need a three-dimensional Lie algebra. And naturally, from all this rotation, degrees of freedom, we will actually have the rotation, so the Lie algebra of rotations, SO3, which you might know, the same as SU2. Okay, so how much do you know SU2? A bit of a question how much I go to through SU2 and SO3 and so on. So I guess there's one important point, at least for which we need. Okay. You might have heard that SU2 is a covering group of SO3. And so the covering is twice and leads to the spin representation for SU2. But the important point which we actually need is basically the relation. This follows from what I'm going to say now. So we need the relation between fundamental representation of SO3 and the joint representation of SU2. And so the joint representation of SU2, it's usually defined on the Lie algebra SU2. And so what does it mean? So fundamental representation of SO3. Okay, you might have seen that. These are our beloved rotations. Rij. Why did this acting? On R3. So you already have seen that actually. In case you introduced fermions in relativistic quantum field theory. So Rij acting on S3 is just our fundamental representation. Actually, if you have introduced the spin representation of the Lorentz group. Okay, and then so for SU2, so we say it's adjoint acts on the adjoint acts on the Lie algebra. Of SU2. And so this is a 3D space, and indeed it's kind of a vector space homeomorphic to R3. And so you know that being a vector space, it has a basis. And so I will recall this basis Tj, and this is to defined as -1/2 sigma I, where these are really the Pauli matrices. Pauli matrices. And so I hope I can find the commutation relation between these things. We have them somewhere. There's always a minus sign question, depending on your conventions. Here we are, small print. So it's really that the commutator here is without a minus sign. So these relations follow just if you take the Pauli matrices. And take the commutator, and these things have also another property that if you take the trace of two of them, you get -1/2 delta I k, which is important to use for computations, should you ever do a computation with these things. So this is our SU2 basis. And we can actually identify this basis also with the basis of R3. And as you might have heard, a joint representation of SU2 on a Lie algebra element is defined by So rho stands for a representation. And let's see whether a joint representation means that you apply to a Lie algebra element. So I define it. So the action, so this means action on a Lie algebra element, is given as this thing, and then there's a question whether I spontaneously manage. Yeah, I think this is even the right order. So it's defined as a matrix product. So here you have matrix product. So this is 2x2 matrices. Our T's are 2x2 matrices. G's are SU2, which means 2 times 2 special unitary group. So it's also 2x2 matrices. And so this this defines a representation because you can check that applying another rho G prime, you get basically the representation property, I guess, which you discussed at some point. And for this, you need to distribute correctly the minus sign here. I hope I did it, so you can check for yourself whether this is the correct minus choice of minus sign. And so the other thing is that this object on the right, on the left-hand side, has to be in the Lie algebra again. And so this is this is something which always happens with a joint representation. So this is actually again in the Lie algebra SU2, which means that you can write this as a combination of your three matrices again. And so this is a joint representation of SU2. And so the trick we use a lot is actually that the rotations, and which is also used in quantum field theory for the Lorentz group. So now we can define a rotation parameterized by a group element G. It's just that this is a two to one parametrization. So there's a sign ambiguity here, which you project out, basically. So this is a rotation. And you can actually apply it now to a basis element of R3, which we identified with our Lie algebra element. So you rotate around your T's. And so what you get here is just a combination. So this defines you a combination of linear combination of T's. And so the nice thing about SU2 is that this fundamental representation of SU3 is actually equal to the adjoint representation of SU2 on the Lie algebra SU2. And here you actually see why this sign ambiguity arises, because you have two G's here, and any sign would cancel out. So what it means is that we can identify the vector representation, which we actually used in our definition, identifying the symmetry. The symmetries, we use the vector representation, the spin-1 representation. And so we can identify it with a joint representation of SU2. And so this is something special about 3D and SU2. And indeed, in 3+1, one doesn't use SO4, actually. In the end, one uses actually SU2. And SO4 is also, it's actually 6-dimensional. It wouldn't even work from dimensionality. Okay. So do we need more about this? So that means that actually, did we discuss at some point? So if you define, for instance, these Lie algebra valued objects, EA, EAJ, TJ, and originally, you know, these fluxes, they had one index. And so we they were transforming in the vector representation. But now we know it's the same as in the joint representation. So at one point in space, it transforms. Now another joint representation in SU2, because here I use the Lie algebra basis. So again, this is a 2x2 matrix. This is a linear combination of matrices, and this is a 2x2 matrices. So here you write the product is just the matrix product. And so this is abstractly written in this way, and so this also holds for the curvature, which is the tensor. So we can define this. And so here you have the same, that it transforms under the joint representation G minus one. And so for the connection, which is not a tensor, and so there we had if you remember, we had an extra term and which was a derivative. So we have this term which looks the same, but then you have the extra term, and if you translate it into what we had at that point, we had rotation, derivative of rotation, of inverse rotation. So now we have G, derivative of inverse G. Okay. And so this defines you how the objects transform under gauge transformations at one spatial point. And the other thing what we discussed is that the connection is there to transport objects from one point to another point in your space. And so this is what the holonomies give you. And so we need to transport these Lie algebra valued objects from one point to the other. And that's why we will have these parallel transport equations. Okay. So just to start in the last 5 minutes. So you have an internal vector V, which already comes contracted with your Lie algebra basis. And so it lives at x. And you want to parallel transport it along a curve, gamma s. And so we want to define the parallel transport of V along this curve. And so this will be V0 parallel transported. And we are using the adjoint action. So how we should, what we should use here is again the adjoint action. However, here I have it actually the other way around for some reason. And everyone uses other conventions, just to keep you flexible. So HS will be the holonomy from gamma 0 to gamma s. And so now you can actually, what you can deduce, introducing these formal objects, HS. So we will derive a formula for HS in the end. And that's the point of this exercise. I mean, not today, but tomorrow, apparently. But now we just derive lots of properties of these H, of these holonomies. so they are objects associated to curves or along curves, you see. We know that V0 transforms in the joint representation. You want, of course, that every parallel transported vector also transforms in the joint representation. And this is defined in this way. So demanding that V of S transforms in the joint representation, you can conclude that your holonomy H of S transforms not in a particular representation, because as you see, you need to apply rotations in two different spatial points. So this just means that if you have x here, and you do a rotation at this point, you have a G0 here. And so you have to accordingly rotate the holonomy, and apparently it's with the inverse. And here at S, so these are just these frame rotations, and they can be different at different spatial points. So here you have GS, and you need to rotate your vector into just this frame. So if the frame rotates, you need to accordingly rotate your holonomy. So just kind of a consistency condition to keep you up with this. Okay. So this, and the nice thing about these holonomies is that, as you can imagine, if you transport something to S and then you transport it further to S prime, and you get a holonomy along a composed curve. So there's an algebraic structure behind it, and you can call it a groupoid structure, but it's not important. So you can compose these things, in the end, we will have these finite holonomies associated to curves, which will be our basic objects. And in the next lecture, we will actually derive this holonomy HS as a functional of the connection. So this will be actually, I don't know if you have seen that, so this will be a path ordered exponentially, you know, integral of our connection. And so we will do, there's two things there. You smear, because it's an integral, you also exponentiate the connection to, because the connection is Lie algebra valued, but what in the end you get is a group element. and this you get by exponentiating the Lie algebra. And so this we will do in the next time. You have to derive the thing, and you might actually, this formula you might very well know, because it's very similar to perturbation theory and quantum field theory, and there you have also encountered time-ordered path integrals. And so it's not very much different from this. Okay, so let's see each other next week. Tomorrow, actually. What's tomorrow? Thursday.